This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. When was the last time you got a letter? Not an email, a physical letter on paper. Because there's something special about seeing someone's words with the uniqueness of their handwriting. What's even more special is receiving those words from someone far away, maybe in danger, fighting for their country and their life.
It's pretty hard to check out this way without much of a fighting chance. But, we can't all live forever. I'm not afraid to die. But I just hate the thought of not seeing you again.
That is an actor performing part of a letter from U.S. Army Lieutenant Tommy Kennedy to his parents. Kennedy was a prisoner of war in World War II. He died in 1945, soon after that letter was sent. He was 23 years old. That letter is one of hundreds in the Center for American War Letters at Chapman University. The extensive collection includes unpublished letters from every major American conflict, starting with handwritten missives from the Revolution, all the way up to emails from Iraq and Afghanistan. Joining us here in studio is Andrew Carroll, the center's founding director. He is on a mission to preserve a million of these personal war stories in his Million Letters campaign. Andy, welcome to 1A.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Andy, you've been collecting these letters for nearly three decades. What got you started?
So the fire is what got it started. That was three decades ago. We're coming up on the 30th anniversary this December. I ironically hated history growing up. I was a sophomore in college, and I got a call from my dad here in Washington, D.C., which is where I'm from, saying the house is burned to the ground. And it was losing the family memorabilia, especially the letters, that really impacted me. And not long after the fire, a distant cousin of mine named James Carroll Jordan, who was a World War II veteran, called to see how we were doing. And I said, Jim, no one was hurt, which is the most important thing, but everything, all the family material is gone. And he said, you know, I was just going through my old World War II footlocker, and I came across a letter I wrote to my wife. I was 23 years old. This is April of 1945 at the end of the war, and I'll send it to you. So this is the actual letter. I got it in the mail. It's on this sort of thin onion skin paper. And the very first line, Dear Betty Ann, I saw something today that makes me realize why we're over here fighting this war. And then he goes into very graphic detail about walking through the Nazi concentration camp at Buchenwald. And it was one of the most riveting and just powerful things I'd ever read. I called Jim. I said, I'll send this back to you. And he said, just keep it. I probably would have thrown it out anyway. So that was the spark. And just through word of mouth, I started getting more letters. And then officially the project began 20 years ago when Dear Abby did a column on it. And we just got the floodgates open. So we're up to about 130,000 letters and emails now from, as you said, every conflict in American history.
You've traveled to about 40 countries collecting letters. What's it been like going around the world to find these letters and then seeing what was written in them?
Not surprisingly, the two most memorable trips were to Iraq and to Afghanistan. And there I got letters both by our troops who were writing home, emails and so forth, but also from Iraqi soldiers who were serving with the Americans or with Afghan interpreters. And so it was what struck me of finding letters from all these different nations is that if you stripped away the dates, the salutations, the locations, it's almost like you wouldn't know what war it was. The emotions were so timeless and universal that it comes through. And that's why I call these letters literature, because they provide such insight, not just into war, but just the human experience.
We asked listeners to write in about the importance of letters to their own service. Here's what Vince from Colorado left in our app, 1A Vox Pop.
I was stationed in Germany in the 90s, and this was back when phone calls were very expensive. It was over a dollar a minute to make a phone call back to the U.S., and so letters were critical and vital to staying in touch with the world. There was no internet. There was no other way to really communicate except via letters or phone calls on the extreme case. And I was long distance engaged to a wonderful woman, and letters meant everything to stay connected and know what was going on. The TV shows we got were the news we got was over a week old usually, and you just really couldn't keep up, especially if you like sports, because you didn't get anything real time in the newspaper. It was always at least a week old.
Vince, thank you for sharing your story with us. Andy, what are some of the other things that you found that make war letters especially unique or special?
So I carry around with me what I jokingly refer to as the football. It's a leather satchel, and inside I keep what I consider a lot of our best letters.
Very different from the nuclear football.
Historical football.
It
cannot get lost. It's never out of my sight. I seriously have, you know, the protection to, you know, keep
it
on me.
Are those handcuffs?
Those are handcuffs. And I was surprised that TSA would let me get through the airport with those, but they're okay.
Those are handcuffs.
They always love to make a joke, like, come on, what are these really for? And I'm like, this satchel cannot get out of my hands.
You have handcuffs.
When you see the letters that I'm carrying around, you'll understand why. So I'm giving you one example. And I love that you just used a current troop, because I was in Iraq, and a service member gave me a DVD letter that he had done to his mom. So he spoke into a camera, burned it onto a disc, and sent it home. Now, this DVD will be obsolete in 5 to 10 years. This is something I keep in the football. This is an original letter from the American Revolution. And it's as legible as the day it was written in 1775.
It's in one of those 8.5 by 11 plastic document sheets.
Yeah, everything, of course, is kept in protective sheeting. But when I love to travel the country talking to schools, veterans groups, historical societies. And the reason I bring the letters is because there's something about holding on to that tangible piece of paper and knowing that the service member who wrote this letter back during the Revolution, you're holding the same, and you can tell it's kind of a cloth, the old cotton type of paper. There's just something really magical about that experience.
You have handcuffs. I know you want to speed past that, but
I've had a couple instances.
Well, let me ask it to you this way. If you did not have those handcuffs and that football got lost, what would that mean to you?
Well, A, there's all sorts of information in it about where to call and who to contact.
But if it never came back?
That would be disastrous. These are I'll just go through a couple more. We have a letter written from inside a ship at Pearl Harbor. It's dated December 7th, 1941, and it's, "Dear Sis, it's now 9:05 Sunday morning. We've been bombed for over an hour." This is an eyewitness account. Similarly, we have a letter by a woman who was at Ground Zero at 9/11. This is her recollection of what she saw, and they're literally, you can't see it, obviously, this is radio, but they're these stain marks. Those are her tears from sobbing as she was recounting watching people going off the buildings and so forth.
For a minute.
Yeah, sure.
I understand the value of the letters.
Right.
What I'm trying to get at is that this is so important to you.
Yes.
You are cuffing yourself to these documents. Do you think the American people understand how important these documents really are?
When I show them, whether it's to young school kids or whether it's to 80-year-old veterans, so I'll show you a few more. They literally gasp. This is probably our most famous letter. This was written by a young American soldier at the end of World War II in Munich. That is on the actual stationery of Adolf Hitler. This young staff sergeant found himself in Hitler's apartment, and Hitler had just killed himself in Berlin. It was the end of the war. And what's most important about the letter is not just that it was written on Hitler. So he found himself in Hitler's Munich apartment as they were rounding up the Nazis and arresting them as war criminals. So on Hitler's stationery, he wrote a letter to his parents about walking through Dachau. So if you just flip it over, you'll see in big letters, he starts talking about the horrors that he'd just seen. Not unlike my cousin who walked through Buchenwald, and he served as an eyewitness to what the Nazis had done. That letter, people say, how much is that worth? What I say about these letters is they're priceless. You cannot put an amount on what these can be valued at. And again, just one of the letters that really, you know, interest people is this. It was written from Anzio. And again, I recognize this as radio, but just envision a handwritten letter. And it was by a soldier who was part of the liberation of Italy. And he put the letter in his rucksack and was shot through the back. And what you can see is the bullet hole, the singed marks that go directly through it. And again, I show this to audiences of all ages, and they literally gasp when they see the actual letter.
Hold on just a second. This is a little overwhelming. I know you're ripping through these, but stop. This is overwhelming. You have a letter on Adolf Hitler's stationery. This is incredible.
Well, and I think you really touched on one of our challenges is people think, oh, this is cute. You run a little project that saves war letters, you know, nice little love letters. That's quaint. Nobody really does it anymore. What I try to keep conveying to people is how invaluable these letters are. They capture history. They give us insight into the human nature about fear and grief and love and homesickness and despair and resilience and all these different emotions. They truly are works of literature. In fact, we have a letter.
Wait.
Yep.
I'm holding Adolf Hitler's stationery. I mean,
that piece of paper was on his desk, and the staff sergeant Horace Evers sat down in this obscenely decadent, you know, chandeliers, gold carpets, everything, and compared it and contrasted it to what the Jews had been enduring at Dachau. And he goes into, again, very explicit detail about what he saw.
A railroad runs along this alongside the camp, and as we walked toward the boxcars on the track, I thought of some of the stories I previously had read about Dachau and was glad of the chance to see.
Well, it goes inside, yeah, but and actually, frankly, it gets a little too graphic for, sort of a family audience. He really goes into detail about what he saw and that these poor inmates were still dying, even though the American medics were there and so forth, because they were so malnourished, the disease was so horrible. But I'm just actually kind of happy to see that you really get the spirit of this project and that these letters are so important. And so what, you know, my whole job is to encourage people to go through their attics, their basements, and contact the Center for American War Letters at Chapman University. And we just want them to know, we want these letters.
We'll continue speaking about the Center of American War Letters with its founding director, Andy Carroll, and we'll get to some more of your stories as well. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make safer journeys for everyone. For starters, all drivers are background checked before their first ride and screened on an ongoing basis. And now Uber has introduced a brand new safety feature called Ride Check, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
I'm Peter Sagal. Sure, you're enjoying this NPR podcast filled with important and useful information, but is it the most important and useful information? Like this.
The museum actually went and made a synthetic version of dinosaur breath.
It's Axe body spray, isn't it?
I believe so, yes.
Wait, don't tell me, from NPR. Listen now and share with your friends.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're talking about the Million Letters Project, which preserves war letters to better understand American history, with Andy Carroll, the founding director of the Center of American War Letters. Before we bring in our next guest, let me get to some of your stories. Sarah tweeted, "My dad served in World War II and became engaged to my mom after enlisting. Both of my parents have passed away. In cleaning out their house, I discovered an old suitcase in the back of a closet. I was stunned to open it and find it stuffed full of letters my parents sent each other during the war. I picked one at random and read it. I was so moved by its contents, I had to put the rest aside for later. I later showed it to a friend who has cleaned out a lot of houses that belong to people my parents' age. His comment was that there is a suitcase or box of letters like that in every house." We also heard from some of you about letters that aren't necessarily as heavy as some of the ones we've read thus far. Bob Leahy was a specialist, a point man in Vietnam. He got in touch with us and reminisced about a friend of his that died during the war. Here's what Bob had to say.
"Somebody noticed that Monty had a slight imperfection because his second and third toes had never quite separated and were held together by some skin. Monty then held his foot up so everyone could see his toes. I asked him why he didn't have the doctors slice through the skin and separate the toes, and Monty answered that he liked it that way because that way he didn't have to wash between his toes. I liked Monty because he had a good sense of humor and was always ready to laugh at the absurdities and frustrations of our life in the Army in Vietnam."
A letter from Army Specialist Bob Leahy, performed by an actor, of course. Do you encounter, Andy, letters that are actually kind of funny or lighthearted?
I'm really glad you mentioned that because not everything we have is so serious and somber. Now, of course, this is war, so we're dealing with life or death. But troops used humor and levity in a way to kind of release their own tension and anxiety, but also it's a message to people back on the home front that I'm okay. You know, we can even make a little bit light of something that happened, a practical joke, whatever it might be. So, like, for example, we have a great play based on these letters. It's out now. It's called If All the Sky Were Paper. And people come out of it, and what they're most surprised about is how much they laughed. They weren't expecting, they were just expecting one heavy letter after another. But it is amazing how troops have used humor in these correspondences and just how funny they can be.
Let's add another voice to the conversation, someone who participated in the project. Joining us from NPR in New York is Benjamin Patton, the grandson of General George S. Patton. He's also the founder of the Patton Veterans Project, a nonprofit designed to help veterans struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder. Ben, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's great to be here, Joshua, and good to hear your voice as well, Andy.
Good to hear you, too.
Your grandfather, General George S. Patton, used an audio recorder to send correspondence to his wife. They were the first audio files that this Million Letters campaign received. Here is a clip from one of those recordings.
I've been away a lot, Joni, and I know it, but I had to come over here and do this thing. And I want you to know, I really enjoyed it. The only thing that I don't particularly like, and I must be completely honest, is I don't like losing my men to those mines. That gets me.
Ben, how did you find these recordings of your father? I beg your pardon, not your grandfather. How did you find these recordings?
Well, actually, it is my father, yes, in circa 1968. And they were among maybe 50 or 60 audio cassettes as well as reel-to-reel tapes that were stored in various drawers in our home in Massachusetts. And when I came upon them, it was just a trove. It was a treasure trove. And I was amazed by it. Now, of course, there's nothing that can match or duplicate an actual letter. The only advantage to these audio letters is that I don't actually have to wear handcuffs.
That is a bit of an advantage. And by the way, we should be clear. When I pointed out the handcuff, he was not wearing one cuff with the other cuff on the bag. They were in a side pocket of the bag, but they are indeed there. What was going through your mind, Ben, when you were listening to these recordings for the first time?
Well, and it's important to point out, in order to answer that, that it was actually really a dialogue. That was the other thing. So you got to see both parts of a dialogue. My father would record his missives of warfare and what was going on in his life on one side of a tape. Then he would send it to my mother, and she would flip it over and record what was going on in her life. And that included me and my brothers and sisters, you know, grabbing the microphone and saying a few words on the other side. So you got this incredible dialogue between a guy who's right in the middle of a combat area where you hear the Hueys in the background and the mortars and so forth and the B-52s. And on the other side, you have this woman in a relatively placid existence in Washington, D.C. So for me, it was just incredibly powerful because somehow something about a person's soul can come through in these audios that I hadn't previously experienced. I mean, I really feel their personality. It's sort of history from a raw perspective, you know, that's made more powerful by the fact that you actually hear their voice and that these are voices of people that I actually know.
And Ben, for those who may not know, maybe there are some younger listeners in our audience or some who aren't quite as versed in World War II, tell us who General Patton was and why he's significant to the story of World War II.
Well, my grandfather was one of the key commanders in both the African and the European campaigns in World War II, and was responsible. Certainly, he had hundreds of thousands of men that served under him, and he was not the top dog, but he was certainly instrumental in the liberation of France and Belgium and Luxembourg and large portions of Germany during the years 1944 and 45. And interestingly, Andy and I have several overlaps, and one of them is that when you read the Buchenwald letter, that was one of the many concentration camps that the Third Army liberated.
And Ben, just to clarify, because we've mentioned your father and your grandfather, which one was the one who served in World War II?
My grandfather served in World War II, and his name was officially George S. Patton, Jr. My father was technically the fourth, although he didn't like the Roman numeral four on the end of his name, so he got rid of it. But yes, my father served in Vietnam and Korea. One tour in Korea and three tours in Vietnam.
John writes, about 30 years ago, my little sister got a phone call. A family who bought my grandparents' home had found a suitcase of hundreds of World War II letters from my dad about his experience as a young radio tech and mule skinner in the Burma-India-China theater. He reveals his wit and skepticism along with his interest in philosophy, learning Chinese, and Beethoven string quartets. Andy, we've gotten some of these letters about letters that were just kind of discovered by serendipity or by accident. How much does that factor in?
Oh, so much. In fact, we did a whole exhibit with the Smithsonian called War Letters Lost and Found. And it was all things like construction workers sent us a box of letters they found in a building they were tearing down. Someone at a bank was, you know, they were discarding a safety deposit box because the owner had passed away and then no one claimed it, sent us letters that were in there. And just one, if I could reference, because this is sort of a recent acquisition, we got a letter from World War II. War I, and it was this incredible archivist at the Smithsonian who was going through our collection, and she's like, do you know that you have a World War I letter about Hemingway? And so we pulled it out, and it was this is before Hemingway became famous, and it's this young lieutenant writing about his new friend, Ernest Hemingway, and he said he got 247 wounds from the mortar shell and machine guns. He has a couple of pounds of metal they have carved out of him. Luckily, most of it was in his legs and not in a vital spot. But here you have one of the earliest mentions of Ernest Hemingway, again, before he's famous, because he's just a young, you know, he's an ambulance driver. And it just, we came across it serendipitously. And it's such, I think, a wonderful part of our collection.
Andy, if you could respond to this question from Mary Lou, who writes, please ask your guest what they do with the letters. How do they store them and where?
That's what's been so great about getting to work with Chapman University. So long story short, I've been doing this project for 15 years. I had to rent out an entire apartment in my building just to start housing the letters because there were so many of them, about 100,000. And a theater professor from Chapman University named John Bennett's called me and said, I think you should do a play based on this. And that's eventually what If All the Sky Were Paper became. And I fell in love with Chapman. And it turns out they have this, you know, beautiful, brand new, very high-tech library, extremely, you know, safe, secure archives. And so I said to them, look, I will give you this entire collection. Back then it was 100,000 letters, just with the promise that you'll continue to the project long after I'm gone. And so they enthusiastically agreed. They've been very supportive. And so what happens is the letters come in. We have professional archivists going through them. They catalog them. Our goal, and it's very time-consuming and expensive, but we hope to do is to digitize the collection. But, you know, they've been part of books like War Letters, part of the play. There have been documentaries. We've had other scholars come and use the letters. And so we just want to keep building the collection. And so anyway, even if people don't have war letters, if they have ideas on how to spread the word, I just talked with a gentleman who runs the Boy Scouts in Florida, and he's looking at trying to get the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts, you know, talking to your parents. And we're coming up on the holidays. This is the perfect time when the families are going to say, hey, where are do we have grandfather's letters or a grandmother who served as a war nurse? So the biggest help that people can do for us, along with sharing their letters, and we prefer originals, photocopies and scans are fine, but just, again, to help us bring attention of the urgency of finding these before they're lost or destroyed.
What are the best ways, Andy, to store these letters? If you find them just in a footlocker somewhere stacked on top of one another, I mean, I see that you have them kind of in individual plastic sleeves, and like, what tips would you give people in terms of preserving these documents?
There's so many things to say about that. It's on our website, warletters.us. We have a whole section on how to preserve your war letters. And one of the main things is, you know, just where they're kept. And, you know, unfortunately, I've seen people, they have letters out in their tool shed where they're gathering mold, or they're up in the attic, and we can see letters that have little rat bites and so forth. So, you know, the main thing is just to keep them in kind of a cool, dark place if possible. I know a lot of people like to frame the letters. That's not good because the light will eventually fade them. And so we want to be that repository to accept and really care for and let people know that the whole spirit of this project is to preserve the sacrifices, the memories, the stories of our troops and their families.
Ben, what about you in terms of the importance of saving these pieces of your family's history, especially since you already kind of knew that your family came from a distinguished military pedigree?
Well, I mean, first of all, I just happen to have come from a family that never threw anything out. I mean, we still have the piece of shrapnel that pierced my great-great grandfather's torso, you know, and the shirt tail that it went through, you know. So I mean, they never threw anything out, and my grandfather kept all of his letters and diaries. But I would say that, you know, from my perspective, particularly with these audio letters, I mean, I've digitized them and so forth. But what they also are a wonderful catalyst for conversation. I mean, and I'm sure Andy will agree with this. I mean, at the holidays, we meet with our older. And by the way, I think if I read your bio correctly, your father was a Vietnam veteran. Is that correct, Joshua?
Mm-hmm.
And so you may have some of these stories in your history as well, but that it's a wonderful way to spark conversation around the holidays to draw those stories out of some of our elder relatives, because a lot of times they haven't been told for a very, very long time, and I really deeply believe that everybody deep down wants to be understood and wants to tell their story. You just have to have the right setting and go about it in the right way.
Now, I'd like to pick up with that when we continue, because I was taught that there are certain things you should not discuss with veterans, and that including their experiences in Vietnam can be very, very touchy. My dad and I have talked about it some, but I'd like to get your thoughts in terms of how best to have that conversation when we continue with Benjamin Patton, the founder of the Patton Veterans Project, and Andrew Carroll, the founding director of the Center for American War Letters at Chapman University. We'll talk about the ways to begin that conversation, and Andy has what he says is the greatest war letter ever written. It's a very tall claim to make, but we'll make some time, let him read that letter, and we'll share some of your letters to us in just a minute. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from The Real Real, the leading reseller of authenticated luxury consignment. Shop luxury clothing, accessories, and fine art at unreal prices from your favorite designers like Louis Vuitton, Gucci, Cartier, and hundreds more. And The Real Real authenticates each item to ensure it's guaranteed authentic. Shop in-store, on the app, or at therealreal.com and receive 20% off select items with promo code REAL.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back now to our conversation with Andy Carroll and Ben Patton. Let's get to a few more of your stories. Clint writes, I have a letter from my great-grandfather in the 7th Infantry written over the space of several weeks in 1876. In it, he opines that the great General Custer will soon take care of these Indian troubles. By the end of the letter, he has heard that Custer and his unit were dead. He later went on to fight in the Battle of Big Hole, where Chief Joseph handed the infantry their butts. And yes, that's the Battle of Big Hole, not the Battle of Big Horn. The Battle of Big Hole was fought in 1877 between the U.S. Army and the Nez Perce tribe of Native Americans. Nicholas writes, my dad was a field surgeon in Patton's army. He must have seen horrible wounds, and his unit had to have been surrounded by screaming and dying soldiers. But his V-mail letters home spoke only of lighthearted topics. We never heard any of the awful death he had to deal with every day during the Battle of the Bulge in Luxembourg, the home country of his grandfather. Ben, have you found any correspondences like the one that Nicholas mentioned that have kind of broadened your perspective of General Patton, either of the generals Patton, beyond what your own family has collected?
Certainly. I mean, things come up all the time. I get letters and emails almost weekly from people that have either served under my father, served under my grandfather. And if they don't have a letter, they have a remembrance. And it's usually very powerful. By the way, I hope that those two listeners will be sending those letters to Andy Carroll, because they sound incredible, that 1876 letter, by the way. But you were asking before about the way into this conversation, you know, particularly around the holidays. And I just had some thoughts on that. I think that you know, you really just need to find the way into these conversations. And I'm mainly focusing on my work with veterans right now through filmmaking, as most of what I do. But I had a side thing that I worked on, which was doing biographies and film biographies about families. And at one point, I remember I was meeting with a World War II veteran, and I opened the conversation by rereading or having him read a letter that he had written to his family as sort of wisdom for my children at an older age. And that was just a way in. And he didn't want to speak to me at all about his experiences. But once he read this letter, remembered that he had written it 20, 30 years ago with advice to his kids, it sort of opened him up to wanting to rekindle some of these memories. And I think you just have to simply find the right setting and the right way to do it, and then just put your iPhone down and push record on the audio and capture it any way you can.
And if they say, I do not want to talk about this, what then?
Well, a lot of times, I think you have to think about, you're going to get to the end of this, but you're just going to try a different way. Sometimes it can be having a different person do it. For instance, some of the reasons that I get hired by families to do their biographies is because I'm not a member of the family, and they can't look at me and say, look, I've told this to you a bunch of times. I don't want to talk about it anymore. I'm a new, fresh face that maybe has some connection to the military, and they open up. So again, you just simply have to just try different ways, and at some point the door will open and you will unlock something. And then they just are really, and I find this with the veterans I work with now, they're really interested in deeply being understood, but they just don't think others are able to do that. And I think in that sense, they don't give us as much credit as we can as younger members of the family, perhaps, to appreciate what they've been through and really seek to do our research and understand it.
Andy, I'd like to get your reaction to another voicemail. Here is what Mark in Montana had to say.
As a 12-year naval officer, I cannot say I ever wrote home an important letter. However, my family did have two letters of importance in our past. One, my grandmother wrote in 1944 to the CEO of the recruit depot training center for my father, asking him to delay my dad's graduation, as she already had two sons fighting in Europe at the time. The second letter received in late 1944 was when my uncle was killed during the Battle of the Bulge. And subsequently, his death benefit was used by my dad and uncle, his oldest uncle, to actually put running water and a toilet in their house on the original homestead.
Wow. Mark, thank you for sharing that story with us. Andy, do you have letters that are not from service members, but maybe from their families or from the military itself?
I'm so glad you mentioned that. A lot of people assume that we just want letters by the troops and veterans. We absolutely want letters by and have letters by the family members. What they go through, the sacrifices they make is an enormous part of the war experience. And now it's not just the wives who are sending their husbands over to serve in past conflicts. It's the wives of the ones who are going over to serve in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so we're having, you know, a whole new angle and perspective on war through those correspondences as well.
You said that you are in possession of what you consider to be the greatest war letter ever written. Tell us about this letter.
Let me preface that by saying I think this letter perfectly encapsulates what the spirit of our project and also that today's Veterans Day. It's written by a black major who was serving in, we'd actually alluded to this earlier, the China, Burma, India Theater, the CBI Theater during World War II. And he was an airman. And a friend of his wrote to him from the States, envious that he was experiencing this history. This is what he wrote back. "You say that you wish you were over here. Although most people think that they are war conscious, are they really? So far removed from the far-flung battlefronts, how can they be? You are really war conscious when you see the airplanes in formation early in the morning, flying to meet the rendezvous, and then see the same formation returning in the evenings. But the number is not the same. 12 went out, but only 9 returned. You wonder what really did happen, those who went down in flames. Do they die as you see them in the movies? I don't think so. Not with a smile on their lips and a happy gleam in their eyes, but rather painfully and with the knowledge that this is it. You'd have to see the wounded streaming back from the front after a battle, above all, to see the light go out of men's eyes. People may think they know what war is like. Their knowledge is facts of the mind. Mine is the war-torn body, scared to soul's depth. When I was in the States, war was far away, unreal. I had read, I had seen pictures, but now I know. Oscar."
Andy, is that part of the purpose of this project, to make war not seem quite so far away, like something that happens over there?
It is absolutely the heart of this project is to convey the humanity of these troops and the reality of warfare. We are not political in any way. Our sole agenda is to ensure that these stories and experiences are preserved and that we understand that these men and women are not statistics. They're soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, but they're also spouses, siblings, loved ones, husbands, wives, I mean, everything. That's what we want to try and get across, is the personal aspect of warfare. And what has been most inspiring to me is to see younger generations get inspired to want to learn more about these sacrifices. And they extend beyond the battlefield. It's not just the risk of getting killed. It's not being there when a loved one is born. It's missing anniversaries. It's the stress it puts on relationships. There's so many things that these letters help convey about warfare that I think it's important for this generation and those to come to know.
Ben, I know we're winding down, but what do vets tell you regarding what they're dealing with now, what they're struggling with now, and whether those struggles are kind of reflected in the letters they write? There's always the story that is written, and then there's the story that's really there. How much do they match up?
That's an interesting question. I think that, the breadth of what they're willing to talk about and share has just grown dramatically, because beyond the battlefield, I mean, we have a lot of things that are afflicting these veterans, from things like military sexual trauma and harassment and just dealing with the notion of transition. There's a rise in spousal suicide. There's a rise in suicide among younger veterans, the suicidal ideation. There's a lot of people that write about what they love about the military as well. So the breadth of topics are growing, and I think that as the veterans feel validated and feel understood, that we really care.
And Ben, for those who want to get in touch with Patton Veterans Project, how do they do it?
Well, you can reach us on the web at pattonveteransproject.org. And essentially what we do is use filmmaking as a therapeutic tool for veterans to be able to relate stories through often fictionalized films that express things, maybe don't retell them in the way that a letter might, but really express things that they've been through in a way that normal conversation doesn't suffice. And so that's the best way to reach us.
That's Benjamin Patton, founder of the Patton Veterans Project. Benjamin, thanks for talking to us.
Such a pleasure.
And Andy Carroll, a historian and the founding director of the Center for American War Letters at Chapman University. Andy, thank you.
Thank you so much.
The show was produced in partnership with Smithsonian Magazine. And if you want to contribute to the Million Letters Project, you can donate your letters through their website, warletters.us. This program was produced by Michelle Harvin with help from Paige Osborne, and it was edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.